You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, June 16th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Devin Carbato, professor of law at UCLA and author of Unreasonable, Black Lives, Police Power, and the Fourth Amendment. Meanwhile, the January 6th hearings continue today, where they'll focus on Trump's efforts to pressure Pence into rejecting the electoral count.
Just do it. Do it, Mike.
The committee also revealed that Clarence Thomas's wife, Ginny, was corresponding with Trump goon John Eastman about overturning the election.
Normal stuff.
Normal. And the leader of the Proud Boys was given plans to occupy congressional buildings, the committee found. They called it the 1776 Returns, with a section entitled Storm the Winter Palace.
Oh my God.
They could have just done parkour in their homes. They wanted to be in
Game
Mission
of
Impossible.
Thrones.
Yeah. But they stormed the Capitol instead, I guess.
Winter Palace.
I know, it's the White House. Right?
Yeah, I guess. The Gore Congress.
Yes. Idiotic. The Fed raised interest rates by 75 basis points yesterday, the largest increase since 1994. Some experts warn that could send the U.S. into a recession. We could help combat inflation with some price controls on oil and gas. We'll get into that in a second. The DOJ has charged the Buffalo mass murderer with 26 counts of federal hate crimes and weapons violations. Some of the charges could lead to the death penalty if the federal government seeks it. We're against that in principle. The New Mexico State Supreme Court has ordered Republican election officials to certify the results of the primary from 9 days ago. They have refused to because of Dominion voting machines being used. Expect more of this, by the way. Sarah Palin has advanced to the August special election for the state's only House seat in Alaska.
Countdown to retirement begins.
I know. How long will she make it? We don't know. She didn't make it through her full time as the governor. It's a lot of work.
It's shorter terms, I guess.
Oh, 2 years I can do.
Ah.
Good news for the content. And lastly, Herschel Walker has admitted that he has not one, but two secret sons.
Wait, I think it was two in addition to the one we found out yesterday.
It's two more secret sons.
So, yeah.
He only produces secret sons, not secret daughters.
I would love to see the Charlie Kirk follow-up with Herschel Walker about absentee fathers.
Me too. Where are the fathers? Where is Father Herschel? All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen, and everyone. Happy to have you. It's Thursday, so it's an Majority Report day. Got to get that merch, and that's in the works. I've just forgotten to do any work on that front. What? Now your mute button's back.
Oh, my mute button is back. Did you negotiate a percentage yet? Because I still need to do that.
Oh, I didn't even think to do that. Honestly,
no,
this is
either.
Why I need your.
I literally just did.
You did it.
No, I just thought of doing that. Like we should maybe.
We probably should.
Yeah, be capitalists here.
That stuff does not come naturally to me. I got to be honest with you.
No, I avoid it actually. That's kind of why I do this job.
Right. So I mentioned this in headlines, but oil prices, they're out of control, and you know I understand that that's hurting a lot of people in this country. I feel incredibly lucky that during these time periods, I'm fairly insulated from it. because I walk and take the subway.
I got two offers that I was thinking about accepting for grad school, which one was Pepperdine in Malibu and the other was here in New York. And
yeah.
I choose New York because of the public transportation. Even though I like driving in North Dakota, I used to just do it often cheap gas in North Dakota. I wanted to get out of that, and it's horrible.
And Pepperdine's supposed to be like the most beautiful university in the country.
Yeah,
so.
That's fine. I'll take New York.
Yeah, and it's I know that a lot of you are probably dealing with this right now, and it's hard to discern really how much price gouging by these oil companies is contributing to gasoline prices. But it's a substantial amount. It's certainly a substantial amount. And with inflation in general, gasoline is accounting for, I think I saw David Dayen write, 20% of inflation last month, which also contributes to the inflation of other goods increasing.
Oh yeah, it's fundamental.
Because of the because of our supply chains and because how much is needed to manufacture those kinds of things. You can put that up from Warren Gunnels.
Yeah, that's good. Warren Gunnels, he's a Bernie Sanders advisor, says oil prices today, $115 a barrel. Gas prices today, $5 a gallon. Oil prices in 2008, $116. Gas prices in 2008, $3.51 a gallon. He says gas prices are $1.50 a gallon higher than they should be because of the greed of big oil. Dispute there. It's time for a windfall profits tax. I would say at the very least. The problem with, I think, where we are politically in this country is like, and I'm not criticizing Gundles here, like, really.
That's a politically possible thing within the context of a Biden administration, if anything at all.
But it's like, we're talking about the FDR administration. You need to threaten, that should be that you're getting taxed. There's going to be a windfall tax.
Yeah.
The threat should be, we're going to nationalize you and kick all the profiteers out of this industry and decide who gets to get oil and at what price. And instead, you know, a windfall tax, look, if that's what happened after that threat, because Congress is Congress and it couldn't get a revolution, fine. But, that's for everybody that's wondering why gas prices are so high. It's not because the Democrats are too unfriendly to the oil industry. That's an oil industry talking point. Come on, guys. It's because those profiteers aren't, we'll play this Ducey clip now.
Yeah, let's play this Ducey clip now. And just to buttress Gunnel's point and Matt's point here, oil companies are seeing record profits right now. The relationship between the barrel price and the price at the pump is entirely fractured, and that fracture is due to greed by oil and gas companies, and they're flexing their muscle. And frankly, I would also say we're going to see a lot more of this during Democratic administrations when they talk about climate change at all. Hey, you want to regulate us? You want to cut into our profits? We're going to make you pay politically by making oil and gas a lot more expensive. But here's Peter Ducey asking John Kirby about of the Biden administration. What's his official title?
He was the Pentagon press secretary, but he's now like a coordinator within the National Security Council.
Gotcha.
He's just like a, you know, amorphous
blob guy.
Yeah.
Right.
Literal blob guy.
A blob guy, both in his title and in what he represents. And so he has this interaction with Peter Ducey about Biden's upcoming trip to Saudi Arabia, where he's going to beg for oil, because like Matt just said, it's there's no stick approach with Biden. It's just, please, please, come on, man. Come on, man. And no, like, threats, actual threats, as opposed to marginal taxes. Here's this interaction.
I have a question about U.S. national security. How is it that you guys have determined that it's in the U.S. national security interest to ask Saudi Arabia to drill more oil instead of just letting oil companies drill more here in the U.S.?
Well, I think you know, Peter, there's some 9,000 unused drilling permits here in the United States as well. The oil production issue is a global issue. And OPEC plus 3 has already increased preset increases by more than 50% just for July and August. And we're grateful to Saudi Arabia's leadership on that. But we've never said that it's a national security interest that somebody has to pump more oil. And again, there's unused permits here in the United States.
But as a national strategic issue.
So, there's a good interaction that I think displays the limited contours of how the Biden administration and naturally, you know, just establishment politicians are viewing this. Because there, I think, are a few options that need to be considered or should be implemented, frankly. One, Biden needs to implement price controls. We've done price controls to combat inflation in wartime in the past, during World War I and World War II, where the public is more amenable to that kind of thing in theory. But frankly, if it's going to get oil and gas prices under control, the political benefits will follow. Biden's just terrified that he's going to get called socialist by Fox News, which he is already getting called, as they hit him on oil and gas prices at the pump. So that is what needs to happen in the short term. Then you can also begin to normalize relations with Venezuela if you're so worried about oil and gas. And thirdly, the big, big goal is nationalizing this, as Matt said. Bradley was talking about this before the show, too. This is the ultimate indication of a failure of neoliberalism, that we are held hostage by these massive oil and gas companies and are at the whims of what they've decided the prices are going to be. And if Mohammed bin Salman wants to be petty and doesn't like Biden because he didn't suck up to him sufficiently and also wants to make him pay politically, so somebody is going to, you know, maybe he can tilt the scales just a little bit on election day for a guy that's in his favor who won't do anything about oil and gas or woman, but on the Republican side, that's not very likely. Like, he's going to do it. They have the ability to flex their muscles as long as we go down this path of being beholden to them and not nationalizing them.
Yeah, it's not clear to me why we didn't go. We talked about this with Derek and Danny of American Prestige on Left Reckoning last night, but why they didn't at least also both, like, do, if you're going to do Saudi Arabia, do Venezuela too. Open up diplomacy there. It looked like there was some hints toward that. And the inertia of the American government and wanting to, like, basically discipline countries that aren't friendly to it, as opposed to, like, bend over backwards to apologize for countries that do support us, like Saudi Arabia, is just really pronounced. But it's really disheartening. Like, this is why we've not gotten anywhere on climate or oil, is because nobody in the video we just showed is a good person. On the one side, you have the hack journalist representing right-wing interests, representing the oil industry, saying, hey, as the oil industry is gouging us, the question is framed, why won't you let the oil industry save us? And then you have
The oil industry, but with the American flag painted on it.
Yeah, exactly. And then you have the Biden administration, which is like, we're going to just ask nicely around the oil industry and Saudi Arabia and all the, you know, various sociopaths and see what they get us.
It's deeply unserious.
Together with us.
But we can't deal with Venezuela, Matt, because they are a totalitarian, awful country that treats its people wrong. Oh, wait. As I go fly over to Saudi Arabia to kiss.
Blinken is still talking about Guaido.
MBS on the mouth. Yeah.
I mean, it's a farce.
All right, with that said, we are going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll be joined by Devin Carbato, professor of law at UCLA and author of Unreasonable Black Lives Police and Black Lives Police Power and the Fourth Amendment. We'll be right back. And we are back. We are joined now by Devin Carbato, professor of law at UCLA and author of Unreasonable Black Lives, Police Power, and the Fourth Amendment. Devin, thanks so much for being here today.
Not at all. It really is my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'm looking forward to our conversation. So Part of what I loved about your book is that you do not treat the Constitution as a religious text, pure in its intentions pure in the outcomes that it tries to realize. That's a pet peeve of mine in American discourse, where it's like the Bible. I think at best that's an ignorant perspective. At worst, it's a racist one. Talk a little bit about the structural, the Fourth Amendment in general, and why you chose to focus on it, and why, in your estimation, it's flawed in terms of how it sets up the police state in this country.
So there are a couple of ways to think about that. I'm sure if your listeners were asked to articulate the Miranda warnings, they would probably be able to do it, because whatever our views are of policing, we probably have our favorite cop show. So everyone knows their Miranda warnings. But people don't necessarily know the text of the Fourth Amendment. So let's think about exactly what the text says. It says we have a right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. And the basic idea is that this text was supposed to create some kind of boundary between lay people and the police. But for Black people, the Fourth Amendment operates more like a gateway. That is to say, it provides the police with access to Black bodies in a number of distinct ways. The easiest way to understand what I mean is, again, for a minute, to just focus on the text, just for a minute, on reasonable searches and seizures. So what that means, basically, is what the police officer does to you is neither a search nor a seizure, then the officer needs no justification. So if you're walking on the street, Emma, and cops approach you, question you, ask for permission to search, etc., none of that is a seizure. None of that implicates the Fourth Amendment. So what that means is that the government can do that, police officers can do that without any justification at all. That's one problem. The other problem is that even when what you have is a search or a seizure, the courts make it really easy for police officers to justify. The classic example is stops and frisks. Stops are seizures, frisks are search, but you just need reasonable suspicion. If I were to ask you to guess, reasonable suspicion, what do you think that translates to as a probability? What's it?
Probably being Black, or as a probability. I mean, not being white, and being in the neighborhood where police want to rack up some numbers for their arrest records, for their quotas.
Fair enough. If I were to ask you to put a number to it, a percentage, and we'll come back to the being Black part in a minute, I promise.
A percentage of what? I'm sorry.
Yeah, so what probability? So is it 50% likelihood of doing something wrong? Is it 20% likelihood of doing something wrong?
What constitutes it in practice? Yeah. Probably, what, 10%?
Probably around that. So it's a really low bar. And part of what the court has said with respect to interpreting reasonable suspicion as well is that if you are in a quote-unquote high crime area, that gives cops, that is a factor on which cops can rely to say they have reasonable suspicion. So just being in a quote-unquote high crime area, we know what high crime area means. It's code word for Black or brown community.
Right. And so just being in that area is enough to create reasonable suspicion. The reasonable suspicion standard that you mentioned, talk about Terry versus Ohio and how that set up. Maybe it goes back further than that, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you cite this in your book, the concept of reasonable suspicion, which also paves the way for stop and frisk. We film here in Brooklyn. We're intimately aware of stop and frisk policies in New York City. What did that decision do for those kinds of police procedures and conduct?
Sure. So I'll back up just a bit and say that with respect to what counts of reasonable suspicion, just to be clear about it, the court says if you are in a high crime area, A, and you're fleeing the police, B, that effectively is enough to give the officer reasonable suspicion. So just think about what that means. But to go back in time to 1968, just think about what's going on in that particular moment. A lot is going on in 1968 in America. The Supreme Court is called upon to determine the constitutionality of stops and frisks. And the person who actually writes the opinion is Justice Warren. Why is that significant? Because Justice Warren is the person who also authored Brown versus Board of Education, the famous case that, of course, declared that separate but equal is unconstitutional. And what Justice Warren does in that case is to say, look, we are effectively going to allow police officers to stop and frisk people. I'm simplifying the ruling a little bit, to stop and frisk people without probable cause. So probable cause is thrown by the wayside, and reasonable suspicion becomes the standard for police officers to stop and frisk, which means it's a low evidentiary hurdle for cops to have. So that is the birth of stop and frisk in constitutional law.
And what that decision, was it unanimous or nearly unanimous? I mean, what can you talk a little bit about the historical context of that decision? Because obviously, that's an era of civil rights, lots of change a little bit after that. But the court had gotten a lot of, I think maybe now contemporarily, gets a lot of credit for some of the decisions that they landed on during that time period. But this one has not aged well.
This one has not aged well. And there are a couple of ways to think about it. So Justice Marshall actually signs on to this opinion.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a part of the justices who say, we've got to do this. And remember, this is a moment in which there's the rhetoric about law and order already emerging, and the sense that we have to do something to control expressions of civil disobedience, to control, again, what people perceive to be unrest more generally. And this was the way in which Justice Warren negotiated that. Now, just a year or so later, Marshall quickly peels off and says, I can't believe we did this. Look what reasonable suspicion now means. But he is a part of the group that says reasonable suspicion is going to be enough to justify stopping and frisking people. Fast forward to the Floyd case. You know a lot about the Floyd case. It takes place in New York, where the question becomes whether the NYPD is violating the Constitution, and Judge Ashira Shindlin concludes that, in fact, there is a constitutional violation, both under the Fourth Amendment and under the 14th. And that was kind of a remarkable moment. And many people concluded from that somehow stop and frisk have been abolished. They've not been abolished. It's still perfectly constitutional for police officers to use stop and frisk, again, based on reasonable suspicion. The problem for Judge Shindlin was that New York police officers didn't even have reasonable suspicion. So her quarrel with the NYPD was around the fact that they were stopping people, frisking people, without reasonable suspicion. And some of the data that I should give you a sense of might be helpful. So between 2004 and 2012, there were 4.4 million stops. That's a ton. Only 12% culminated in arrests. 12%. Think about that.
I didn't mean to cut you off, but that lends credence to what people understand fundamentally if they've listened to this show. But that it is a vehicle for harassment, as opposed to the actual outcomes that are said to be being sought.
Precisely. And to underscore that point, 52% of the people who were 52% of the people who were stopped were also frisked. And wait for it, in only 1% of those people did they find weapons. So again, they're not finding weapons, they're not arresting people. It's a programmatic project of discipline and social control rather than a serious law, a serious investigatory tool to solve crimes.
So now here's like the bigger question about that, and we can return to some of the different ways that policing exploits the Fourth Amendment, but is it not just inherent? Is the system of control inherent to the Fourth Amendment, or do you believe that it was bastardized in order to fit into our, you know, white supremacist police state? Because to me, I think the subjectivity inherent in the text, I lean more towards the former.
So there are a couple of ways to think about that. One is to first take the historical perspective and ask, so who was the Fourth Amendment intended to protect? So remember, the Fourth Amendment is added to the Constitution in 1791. So it's part of the Bill of Rights. Why is that significant? Mm. It's significant because in 1791, we're talking about a slave constitution. We're talking about a constitution that legitimized and anticipated slavery. That's the A part. The B part is it's also a constitution that imagines that Black people will be re-caught by slave masters without any due process at all. So one could say, against that historical backdrop, that the Fourth Amendment is working the way the Fourth Amendment was supposed to work. It wasn't intended to protect Black people. I don't think that's a particularly controversial argument. And indeed, what you could say, if you're an originalist, you should understand that originally the Fourth Amendment was not intended for us, where us means Black people. Again, shouldn't be a controversial argument. Now, having said all that, you and I both know that constitutional text, when you read the text, they're not self-executing. By that I mean you add value to them. And part of the ways in which I demonstrate that particular point in the book is through chapter 6 and chapter 7. So in chapter 6 of the book, I have the readers engage an opinion called Wren versus United States. So this is a unanimous opinion in which the court actually constitutionalizes racial profiling. And let me be clear about what I mean by that. So let's say the police observe me driving down the street of Los Angeles afternoon as well. Both of us are driving down the street of action. There's no dispute about that. Trafficking. But they realize they can only stop one of us. So Officer A says to Officer B, let's stop the Black person. And to avoid any confusion, I would be the Black person, not you. So they stop me in this particular moment. And the question becomes, is that constitutional? The Supreme Court says, yes, under the Fourth Amendment. Why? Because the officer had probable cause to stop us. So the fact that the officer chose to stop me based on race doesn't matter if the officer has probable cause. Again, a unanimous Supreme Court, including the great late Ruth Bader Ginsburg, co-signs this. Mm. Right? So that's a very clear moment in which racial profiling is being constitutionalized. And why that matters? So this is the only piece of legal advice I will give, which is this. If you drive your car, you violate a traffic code. You cannot drive without violating a traffic code, which means that it's easy for police officers to stop you anyway, and now they can stop you on the basis of race, consistent with the Fourth Amendment. So I have the readers read that particular opinion so they can get a sense of the ease with which Black lives can be disposable in the context of constitutional law. And then I have them read the next chapter, which is my rewriting that opinion in a way that comes out differently, to say that you can read the Fourth Amendment, notwithstanding its history, to actually make Black lives matter more than they currently do in the context of law. So it's a nice juxtaposition in the sense of saying, that's what the court did. It wasn't inexorable. This is what they could have done. Read it. Tell me if I'm crazy.
Well, Ruth Bader Ginsburg did seem to have somewhat of a blind spot when it comes to race. I think, you know, that this opinion not aging well is a bit in keeping with her history, which is, you know, like many people, complicated. But I am fascinated by the, you mentioned about if you were an originalist, you would have the context that you then describe about the Fourth Amendment. Can you expand on the notion of, and this is a bit of a larger question, I apologize if it's a diversion, the Constitution and amendments like the Fourth Amendment being there to protect property owners, in particular, men that held property, which at the time included slaves, and how that is just so inextricable from the context that we're living in today in 2022 when looking at this document.
I mean, I think the bottom line here, I think, to be somewhat simplistic about it, is that originalists tend to be selectively originalist. By that I mean, they're not originalist about the original sins of this nation vis-a-vis its racial and gender projects. I mean, it's absolutely uncontestable that our constitutional history is rooted in sexism, is rooted in patriarchy, is rooted in racism, and that's there. People do make arguments about the extent to which the Reconstruction moment fixed all of that. But it's after the Reconstruction moment that we get Jim Crow. So it's unclear how one can mark that moment as a fix to a racial project when that moment becomes its own new racial project. And one of the ways I sometimes think about this with respect to questions about racial justice is to sort of think about it in 7 days. And at the end of which there's kind of a multiple choice question. So in day one, there's no dispute that group A has been enslaved. Everyone says, yeah, that happened. Day two, let's just say slavery ends, at least formal chattel slavery ends, but there's still an afterlife of slavery. There's no compensating group A for the fact that they were enslaved. None of that. But anyway, slavery ends. That's day two. Day three, group A is now Jim Crow. Everyone agrees that that happened, subject to constitutionalized, legalized racial segregation. That's day three. Day four, there's no compensation for that, but at least you have Brown versus Board of Education, which says you can't have racial segregation in the context of schools. Day five, there's massive resistance to Brown versus Board of Education. Segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. You have intentional discrimination everywhere. You have violence preventing Black people to vote. All of that is happening. And then you have day six. You have civil rights intervention, the second Reconstruction, anti-discrimination law. And day seven, the same group A is over-incarcerated, underemployed, overrepresented in homelessness, circumscribed access to the ballot, underrepresented in political leadership, underrepresented in educational institution. And the multiple choice question is why? Answer A, there's something wrong with group A. Answer B, it's just chance that group A's history happened, but it's not playing a role with respect to what's happened to group A now. Or answer C, it's because of a racialized history why you see this. I pick C. Now, you can have a fight about it, but it seems to me that the basic way to understand contemporary forms of racial inequality is to tell that 1 through 6 story and get people to pick a fight with you. So what are you going to fight with me about? Which day did I get wrong? It's hard to say that I got any of those days wrong, I think, unless I'm missing something.
No, you didn't. I mean, I mean, frankly, it's just willful ignorance to ignore those kinds of steps. And we do not have the requisite historical understanding in this country, I think, for a lot of people to deal with that. But I mean, you know,
and at the same time, not to interrupt you, we're trying to close down conversations about that history before we even understand it.
That's absolutely correct. And that's purposeful, frankly. I want to take a bit of a turn because you talk about the structure of policing in your book, and you identify seven different levels of policing in this country. Can you dive into those levels and talk a bit about them?
Sure. And I'll precisely because you're not reading the text and people are listening, I'll make it slightly less complex. But the basic idea is this. In thinking about problems of police violence, the first question you might ask yourself is this. What are the forces that creates the possibility for police officers to interact with Black people to begin with. And the reason one wants to ask that question is this: repeated exposure to the police creates the possibility that they can harm you. If you're not having contact with the police, they can't stop and frisk you, they can't kill you. So our central question is, what are the factors that puts African-Americans in front of the police? I argue Fourth Amendment is one such factor. So that's one important structure we need to think about. Another important structure has to do with police culture, police trainings, police unions. If police culture encourages violence, even implicitly, then clearly you will see violence. If police trainings don't attend to problems of violence, clearly you will see violence. And if police unions are much more interested in, say, protecting police officers and holding them accountable, again, you'll see violence. Another crucial question that we sometimes don't think enough about is this: what happens when police violence interacts with the legal system? By that I mean, there's no dispute that someone's been brutalized, no dispute that someone's been killed. What now happens when one brings those facts in front of the legal system? What are the outputs? One output is justifiable force. Police violence plus the legal system equals justifiable force. And there are a number of ways in which your listeners I know have seen this. One is prosecutorial decisions not to bring charges. Someone's been brutalized, someone's been killed, but the prosecutor says, I'm not going to bring charges. That's a justifiable force moment. Or the prosecutor brings charges, but the grand jury says, we're not going to issue an indictment. That's another moment in which police violence, legal system, justifiable force. Or prosecutor brings charges, grand jury issues an indictment, and a judge or a jury says no conviction. These are all moments in which police violence, fact, enters the legal system and comes out as justifiable force. That's one problem. Another problem, of course, is qualified immunity. I'm not in this moment going to get into the whole of qualified immunity, because if I do, you'll be saying, come back, Devin, come back, and I'll be a problem. But the point is that everyone understands that qualified immunity erects a really high bar to holding police officers accountable. Everyone kind of gets that. The debate is whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, not whether it's a thing. The problem is even worse in the sense that assuming you jump the qualified immunity hurdle and you win a lawsuit against a police officer, assuming you do that, who pays the damages? Not the police officer, your tax dollars. Cities and municipalities end up paying. And finally, try suing a police department or a city for acts of violence in which its officers engage. You will not win. That is an impossible project.
Well, you mentioned, sorry to cut you off, but Breonna Taylor's money that was paid to her family is a great example of that coming out of the coffers of the taxpayer, as opposed to the police department being held accountable. Continue. I apologize.
And there are lots and lots of examples of just that point. The disparity is quite staggering between what police officers actually pay and what cities and municipalities pay. So we are paying for police violence is the way to think about it.
And this, we're experiencing this in real time in the fallout from the Uvalde massacre, where you see the police department got 40% of the town's budget in Uvalde. And it seems that they are dodging or attempting to cover up something, because their story has changed around a dozen times about what actually went down when there was the active mass shooter inside of that elementary school. And I'm a bit frustrated, because it feels like we're still having the same conversation and Republicans are already saying police need more funding, when they were incredibly well funded. There were tens of police officers there with as much gear as they could possibly imagine, and it still seemed to do nothing, and they're still lying and hiding from investigators within the state of Texas. why do you see, I'm curious about your thoughts about what's happening in Uvalde, but two, why is there this persistent desire seemingly from a lot of the public to see these incidents as anomalies as opposed to obvious patterns?
So I want to answer your question not by talking about that particular moment in a way, because we have more information, more data that's available to your listeners and that I would encourage them to take a look at by way of Ferguson. Why do I say by way of Ferguson? Because Ferguson ended up producing a Department of Justice report. And that report is a must read. Why? Because it reveals the extent to which racism and classism were bureaucratized as ordinary features of governance. By that I mean, the report reveals the degree to which policing was employed as a revenue-generating mechanism and ended up funding 20 to 35% of the city's budget. So you see how this ties into the question that you raised. We have that data. We know how it operates, where people are issued fines, right, that they can't pay. So the standard way in which this worked was something like this. You get a warrant for something ridiculous. You show up, let's say, because there's a mandatory court appearance. You can't afford to pay. What happens? Well, maybe you get arrested in the spot, or you get a higher fine, or plausibly, you get your driver's license revoked, and then you drive without your driver's license and you're arrested. I mean, all of this resulted in a regime of social control where people would find themselves fined, arrested, incarcerated, can't get out of jail because they have no money to post bail, and the collateral consequences of all of that. So it's implicated not just police officers, but a system of governance writ large, which is why it's a mistake to have a conversation about policing that focuses on whether individual police officers are engaged in individual acts of violence against individual Black people. That's not the way to think about it. We should be asking ourselves, what are the sources of police power? How are those sources implicated in government? And how can we peel away at those particular structures?
You mentioned how the traffic stop dynamic and how the more interactions that you have with police, the more likely you are going to be a victim of police violence, etc. What is your sense about the and I guess what did you study and research about the legal basis behind traffic policing? Because frankly, it seems like if we want to defund the police and restructure them, which I do, traffic cops and having police with guns there to stop somebody for a traffic violation should be one of the first things to go. What is some of the legal precedent that has led to that being such a large part of police work? And how does that get detangled?
Well, I think the precedent is very much the case that I referenced earlier, and I only told part A of the story about that case. Again, the Wren versus United States case. Part of what that case does as well, to be clear, it suggests that officers can use traffic stops as a pretext to investigate crimes for which they have no probable cause. So again, remember what I said earlier, that if you drive a car, police officers can find some easy way to stop you because you're going to violate a traffic code. I mean, that's just going to happen. And I should be clear to give you some examples of some of those violations. So tell me what this means. Driving left of center on a grade or a curve. I don't know what that means. Driving too slowly. Following too closely. I mean, these are all predicate bases on which an officer can stop you. So the officer can stop you. You drive, you can get stopped. That's the A. And the officer can now legitimately investigate some other crime for which the officer has no probable cause. if the officer stops you for driving left of center on a grade or a curve, if the officer stops you for that, the officer can effectuate a full-blown arrest. For whatever that is, which we don't know what it is, but whatever it is, the officer can arrest you for it. If the officer stops you for that, the officer can ask you to get out the car. Just willy-nilly. If there's a passenger in the car, the officer can ask the passenger to get out the car. I mean, so part of the story I tell in the book about traffic stops is the way in which they can function as gateway seizures. So people need to understand all the ways in which traffic stops can expose people to more intrusive encounters and ones that can culminate in death. It's not accidental or shouldn't be surprising that some of the episodes of police killings have as their starting point a traffic stop. Shouldn't surprise us. And so thinking about the source of police power then in the traffic stop context is crucial. So I agree that the peeling away that power would be an important move to make.
How do you feel about, we're talking about gun control in this country right now, and it's something I'm 100% in favor of, and I can't speak for you, but I think many people are. It's quite popular, banning assault rifles, among other things. But you talk about how the Fourth Amendment has been so abused by police in a racist way, targeting Black people, other non-white groups in this country. Do you feel that there's a tension between some of those calls for gun control and how that might fall on non-white members of American society if that were to come to pass?
Say more about what you mean by that. If in other words, how gun control would affect non...
Say there's some sort of searches and seizures and weaponry that would be targeted. Would that lead to more police power structurally that could be used in order to target Black people in the country?
My views on gun control are pretty mainstream. I mean, I think most people think that we're kind of out of sync with respect to the degree to which people can access guns and the kinds of guns that are floating about every day on in our various neighborhoods. I mean, I think so the gun control thing, I don't fully get why it's such a hard nut to crack, but I really, as a foreigner, I mean, I don't completely understand that, but it's something that is hard to make progress on, again, for reasons I don't fully understand. The only thing I want to say about the gun control issue as it relates specifically to the Second Amendment takes us back to a point about law and legal consciousness in this sense. And think about what could happen to Roe v. Wade, what likely will happen, or how that will shake out. People on the right make Supreme Court cases a project. They talk about them, they mobilize them in their political organizing, and they change the law. The Second Amendment now was not what it was two decades ago. People on the left, not so much. I mean, we don't have our cases that we lift up. Who talks about Wren versus United States? Case that constitutional. I mean, who knows that case? Who knows that in order to bring a discrimination suit against the government, you need to prove that someone acted intentionally against you? Who's going to prove that? So solving racism by way of finding a bad actor. I mean, how much dismantling of racial inequality is that going to perform? Who's marching saying this case is crazy? Meanwhile, conservatives have their cases, you know, that their projects that build on legal consciousness to stage social movements. And I think the left is behind on that score.
I'd love to. Yeah, fair enough. I mean, my question was really just about how, you know, some of the gun control measures historically, you know, were targeting Black Panther members. I want us to be and it's a bit beyond the scope of your book, I understand, but intentional about not using these measures to further embolden police, give them more resources that they can use to crack down on non-white people in this country.
Yeah, I think you know that there's always a way in which particular kind of rights are asymmetrically dished out. So from rights to citizenship to rights to gun, whatever the right is, Black people are not going to have it in the same way that white people. I mean, that's like my starting point. So, and one can think about that across every dimension. And indeed, even if we think about reproductive justice, reproductive rights, I mean, the right to that Black women experience very differently than white women, for example. So I think any right you name, I will say there's an asymmetrical arrangement with respect to people's ability to access it. And guns are no different in that regard.
Absolutely. I wanted to touch on the point that you just made about how the right has their hobby horses, for lack of a better phrase. They have their Roe. They have their Casey. They have their Supreme Court cases that are the targets that they use to galvanize voters. But more importantly, in my opinion, they have legal apparatuses, or they have groups that like the Federalist Society, other ways that they're stacking the courts with judges who are going to put forward their agenda. And so, as you say, the left doesn't have that, but there are some, hopefully, that the Biden administration is doing a good job in this regard. They are confirming federal judges at a rapid rate, and we need more of that, frankly.
I mean, just think about the past opportunities that were missed.
Right.
And the degree to which this was just not a project. I mean, not a project. I'm thinking about, you've got to have justices and judges who are going to think about law in a liberatory, egalitarian way. Imagine that. It's controversial to want judges who are going to be egalitarian about the Constitution. That is somehow an issue that one needs to fight for. But it wasn't the case, or it hasn't been the case, that the judiciary has been a focus of people who hold egalitarian principles. It's been an issue for people who, you know, think that, you know, the Constitution should be interpreted in ways that deny people freedoms.
Yes, and so that, I think that we're a bit Johnny-come-lately on that front, unfortunately, yeah. And I don't know how many rights are going to roll back in the decades that we're going to be catching up to that time period. But I guess I was curious of what you made of the right's ability to prioritize their agenda in the court system, and how what that means for the next few decades, as I say, the future in this country, where we're now playing catch up.
We are playing catch up, and I think we need to think about that playbook that has put us in this particular position. And there are a couple of ways to take up that question. If we remind ourselves, for example, that the Supreme Court is not the only game in town, that there are other spaces for law reform, recognizing that law reform isn't the only answer, of course, but it is one place to effectuate some kind of change, then, you know, one can take a bottom-up approach. I mean, think about where we landed with respect to something like marriage equality. Marriage equality didn't start at the Supreme Court. It started at people pushing, you know, their employers to do something, and then city government to do something, and then state legislators and state courts to do something, and then the Supreme Court caught up. So it reversed the order of change, if you like, by making it a local set of interventions that percolated up in a particular kind of way. And I think there are a lot of ways in which one might have to think about that kind of strategy vis-a-vis a range of social justice questions, not to see the Supreme Court to reign, I don't believe that. Can't give that up. But to think about other avenues for specifically focusing on law reform, again, with the big caveat that this is not the only or even the most important game in town, but recognizing that if you're in this particular space, that it's not just about the Supreme Court.
Well, Devin Carbado, professor of law at UCLA, author of Unreasonable, Black Lives, Police Power, and the Fourth Amendment. We will put a link to your book in the description. If you're listening on a podcast, it will also be there and at majority.fm. Devin, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate the discussion.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Take
Thank
care.
You. Bye. All right. With that said, we are going to wrap up the first hour of this program. But not before taking a rocket ship to the Matt Lekian media universe.
Yeah, we had Derek Davison and Daniel Bessner of American Prestige on to talk about foreign policy, Venezuela, Saudi Arabia. We also talked about the Democrats and how they seem sort of just like a ghost ship headed for oblivion into the midterms as they don't do anything. So, and we also we went deep on Bitcoin and some other stuff. So, Patreon.com/LeftReckoning. We had a David's friend Rob in the free post game last night, which aired on Twitch.tv/LeftReckoning. So check that stuff out.
Yes. All right. Well, we don't have them yet, but that's fine. You guys know what to do. If you would like to, I don't know why I said that, but check out Doomed, check out Scam Economy, both of Matt Binder's shows, especially if you're interested in the crypto crash right now. Binder is prescient, and so he got ahead of this crypto crash, and also the Discourse, which is the show of Brandon Sutton. All right, I just got distracted for a second. We'll be taking your calls in the fun half, 646-257-3920. That is the first time I did that from memory. There you go. Wow. Oof. And I didn't even stumble. And we'll be doing some clips, including Anna Delvey will be making an appearance in the fun half. Will I attempt the accent? You'll have to see.
Check your wire.
That's pretty good.
The wire is wrong.
All right, guys. See you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority
Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
You.
What is up, everyone? Nomi Key.
You did it!
Let's go, Brandon!
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today!
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. And let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is it?
Yes.
Is it me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is it me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm gonna go start.
Who libertarians?
They're so stupid though. Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I wanna say. 857-210-3551. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes, satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we seen you. All right, folks.
folks.
It's just the wheat being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.